Chapter 18. The Strength of This Place. Perrin ran through the darkness. Trails of watery mist brushed his face and condensed in his beard. His mind was foggy, distant. Where was he going? What was he doing? Why was he running? He roared and charged, ripping through the veiled darkness and bursting into open air. He took a deep breath and landed on the top of a steep hill covered with short, patchy grass, with a ring of trees at its base. The sky rumbled and churned with clouds, like a boiling pot of tar. He was in the wolf dream. His body slumbered in the real world, on this hilltop with Fael. He smiled, breathing deeply. His problems had not diminished. In fact, with the White Cloak ultimatum, they seemed magnified. But all was well with Fael. That simple fact changed so much. With her at his side, he could do anything. He leaped down from the hillside and crossed the open area where his army camped. They had been here long enough that signs had appeared in the wolf dream. Tents reflected the waking world, though their flaps were in a different position each time he looked at them. Cook fire pits in the ground, ruts in the pathways, occasional bits of refuse or discarded tools. These would pop into existence, then vanish. He moved quickly through the camp, each step taking him 10 paces. Once he might have found the lack of people in the camp eerie, but he was accustomed to the wolf dream now. This was natural. Perrin approached the statue at the side of the camp, then looked up at the age-pocked stone, overgrown with lichen of black, orange, and green. The statue must have been posed oddly, if it had fallen in such a way. It almost looked as if it had been created this way, an enormous arm bursting from the loam. Perrin turned to the southeast, where the White Cloak camp would be found. He had to deal with them. He was increasingly certain, confident even, that he could not continue until he had confronted these shadows from the past. There was one way to deal with them for certain. A careful trap using the Ashaman and Wise Ones, and Perrin could hit the children so hard that they shattered. He could maybe even destroy them permanently as a group. He had the means, the opportunity, and the motivation. No more fear in the land, no more White Cloak mock trials. He leaped forward, soaring 30 feet and falling lightly to the ground. Then he took off, running southeast along the road. He found the White Cloak camp in a forested hollow, thousands of white tents set up in tight rings, the tents of some 10,000 children, along with another 10,000 mercenaries and other soldiers. Balwer estimated that this was the bulk of the remaining children, though he had been unclear on how he'd gotten that knowledge. Hopefully, the Dusty Man's hatred of the White Cloaks wasn't clouding his judgment. Perrin moved among the tents, looking to see if he could discover anything that Elias and the Aiel had not. It was unlikely, but he figured it was worth an attempt while he was here. Besides, he wanted to see the place with his own eyes. He lifted flaps, moved between groupings of tents, inspecting the place and getting a feel for it and its occupants. The camp was arranged in a very orderly manner. The insides were less stable than the tents themselves, but what he saw was also kept orderly. The White Cloaks liked things neat, tidy, and carefully folded, and they liked to pretend the entire world could be polished up and cleaned the same way, people defined and explained in 1 or 2 words. Perrin shook his head, making his way to the Lord Captain Commander's tent. The organization of the tents led him to it easily, at the center ring. It wasn't much larger than the other tents, and Perrin ducked inside, trying to see if he could find anything of use. It was furnished simply, with a bedroll that was in a different position each time Perrin looked at it, along with a table holding objects that vanished and appeared at random. Perrin stepped up to it, picking up something that appeared there. A signet ring. He didn't recognize the signet, a winged dagger, but memorized it just before the ring vanished from his fingers, too transient to stay long in the wolf dream. Though he'd met with the White Cloak leader and corresponded with the man, he didn't know much about the man's past. Perhaps this would help. He searched through the tent a while longer, finding nothing of use, then went to the large tent where Gaul had explained that many of the captives were being kept. Here he saw Master Gil's cap appear for a moment, then vanish. Satisfied, Perrin walked back out of the tent. As he did so, he found something bothering him. Shouldn't he have tried something like this when Fail was kidnapped? He'd sent numerous scouts to Maldon. Light he'd had to restrain himself from marching off to find Fail on his own. But he'd never tried visiting the place in the wolf dream. Perhaps it would have been useless. But he hadn't considered the possibility, and that troubled him. He froze, passing a cart parked beside one of the white cloak tents. The back was open, and a grizzled silver wolf lay there watching him.
"I do let my attention grow too narrow, Hopper," Perrin said. "When I get consumed by a goal, it can make me careless. That can be dangerous. As in battle, when concentrating on the adversary in front of you can expose you to the archer on the side."
Hopper cracked his mouth open, smiling after the way of wolves. He hopped from the cart. Perrin could sense other wolves nearby, the others of the pack he had run with before. Oak Dancer, Sparks, and Boundless.
"All right," he said to Hopper. "I'm ready to learn."
Hopper sat down on his haunches, regarding Perrin.
"Follow,"
the wolf sent. Then vanished. Perrin cursed, looking about. Where had the wolf gone? He moved through the camp, searching, but couldn't sense Hopper anywhere. He reached out with his mind. Nothing.
"Young bull."
Suddenly Hopper was behind him.
"Follow."
He vanished again. Perrin growled, then moved about the camp in a flash. When he didn't find the wolf, he shifted to the field of grain where he'd met Hopper last time. The wolf wasn't there. Perrin stood among the blowing grain, frustrated. Hopper found him a few minutes later. The wolf smelled dissatisfied.
"Follow," he sent. "I don't know how," Perrin said. "Hopper, I don't know where you're going."
The wolf sat down. He sent an image of a wolf pup joining others of the pack. The pup watched his elders and did what they did.
"I'm not a wolf, Hopper," Perrin said. "I don't learn the way you do. You must explain to me what you want me to do." "Follow here."
The wolf sent an image of, oddly, Emmons Field. Then he vanished. Perrin followed, appearing on a familiar green. A group of buildings lined it, which felt wrong. Emmons Field should have been a little village, not a town with a stone wall and a road running past the mayor's inn paved with stones. Much had changed in the short time he had been away.
"Why have we come here?" Perrin asked.
Disturbingly, the wolf head banner still flew on the pole above the green. It could have been a trick of the wolf dream, but he doubted it. He knew all too well how eagerly the people of the Two Rivers flew the standard of Perrin Golden Eyes.
"Men are strange,"
Hopper sent. Perrin turned to the old wolf.
"Men think strange thoughts," Hopper said. "We do not try to understand them. Why does the stag flee, the sparrow fly, the tree grow? They do. That is all."
"Very well," Perrin said.
"I cannot teach a sparrow to hunt," Hopper continued, "and a sparrow does not teach a wolf to fly." "But here you can fly," Perrin said. "Yes, and I was not taught. I know."
Hopper's scent was full of emotion and confusion. Wolves all remembered everything that one of their kind knew. Hopper was frustrated because he wanted to teach Perrin, but wasn't accustomed to doing things in the way of people.
"Please," Perrin said, "try to explain to me what you mean. You always tell me I'm here too strongly. It's dangerous, you say. Why?"
"You slumber," Hopper said. "The other you. You cannot stay here too long. You must always remember that you are unnatural here. This is not your den."
Hopper turned toward the houses around them.
"This is your den. The den of your sire.
this place. Remember it. It will keep you from being lost. This was how your kind once did it. You understand?
It wasn't a question, though it was something of a plea. Hopper wasn't certain how to explain further.
I can try, Perrin thought,
interpreting the sending as best he could. But Hopper was wrong. This place wasn't his home. Perrin's home was with Fail. He needed to remember that somehow, to keep himself from getting drawn into the wolf dream too strongly.
I have seen your she in your mind, young bull,
Hopper sent, cocking his head.
She is like a hive of bees, with sweet honey and sharp stings.
Hopper's image of Vail was that of a very confusing female wolf, one who would playfully nip at his nose one moment, then growl at him the next, refusing to share her meat. Perrin smiled.
The memory is part, Hopper sent. But the other part is you. You must stay as young bull.
A wolf's reflection in the water, shimmering and growing indistinct as ripples crossed it.
I don't understand. The strength of this place,
Hopper sent an image of a wolf carved of stone,
is the strength of you.
The wolf thought for a moment.
Stand. Remain. Be you.
With that, the wolf stood and backed up, as if preparing to run at Perrin. Confused, Perrin imagined himself as he was, holding that image in his head as strongly as he could. Hopper ran and jumped at him, slamming his body into Perrin. He'd done this before, somehow forcing Perrin out of the wolf dream. This time, however, Perrin was set and waiting. Instinctively, Perrin pushed back. The wolf dream wavered around him, but then grew firm again. Hopper rebounded off him, though the heavy wolf should have knocked Perrin to the ground. Hopper shook his head as if dazed.
Good,
he sent, pleased.
Good. You learn. Again.
Perrin steadied himself just in time to get slammed by Hopper a second time. Perrin growled, but held steady.
Here,
Hopper sent, giving an image of the field of grain. Hopper vanished, and Perrin followed. As soon as he appeared, the wolf slammed into him, mind and body. Perrin fell to the ground this time, everything wavering and shimmering. He felt himself being pushed away, forced out of the wolf dream and into his ordinary dreams.
No,
he thought, holding to an image of himself kneeling among those fields of grain. He was there. He imagined it, solid and real. He smelled the oats, the humid air, alive with the scents of dirt and fallen leaves. The landscape coalesced. He panted, kneeling on the ground, but he was still in the wolf dream.
Good,
Hopper sent.
You learn quickly. There's no other option,
Perrin said, climbing to his feet.
The last hunt comes,
Hopper agreed, sending an image of the White Cloak camp. Perrin followed, bracing himself. No attack came. He looked around for the wolf. Something slammed into his mind. There was no motion, only the mental attack. It wasn't as strong as before, but it was unexpected. Perrin barely managed to fight it off. Hopper fell from the air, landing gracefully on the ground.
Always be ready,
the wolf sent.
Always, but especially when you move.
An image of a careful wolf, testing the air before moving out into an open pasture.
I understand, but do not come too strongly,
Hopper chided. Immediately, Perrin forced himself to remember Fail and the place where he slept. His home. He faded slightly. His skin didn't grow translucent, and the wolf dream stayed the same, but he felt more exposed.
Good,
Hopper sent.
Always ready, but never holding on too strong. Like carrying a pup in your jaws. That's not going to be an easy balance, Perrin said.
Hopper gave a slightly confused scent. Of course it was difficult. Perrin smiled.
What now? Running, Hopper sent. Then more practice.
The wolf dashed away, zipping in a blur of gray and silver off toward the road. Perrin followed. He sensed determination from Hopper, a scent that was oddly similar to the way Tam smelled when training the refugees to fight. That made Perrin smile. They ran down the road, and Perrin practiced the balance of not being in the dream too strongly, yet being ready to solidify his sense of self at any moment. Occasionally, Hopper would attack him, trying to throw him from the wolf dream. They continued until Hopper, suddenly, stopped running. Perrin took a few extra steps, surging ahead of the wolf before stopping. There was something in front of him. A translucent, violet wall that cut directly through the roadway. It extended up into the sky and distantly to both the right and the left.
Hopper? Perrin asked. What is this? Wrongness, Hopper sent. It should not be here.
The wolf smelled angry. Perrin stepped forward and raised a hand toward the surface, but hesitated. It looked like glass. He'd never seen anything like this in the wolf dream. Might it be like the bubbles of evil? He looked up at the sky. The wall flashed suddenly and was gone. Perrin blinked, stumbling back. He glanced at Hopper. The wolf sat on his haunches, staring at the place where the wall had been.
Come, young bull, the wolf finally sent, standing. We will practice in another place.
He loped away. Perrin looked back down the road. Whatever the wall had been, it had left no visible sign of its existence. Troubled, Perrin followed after Hopper.
Burn me, where are those archers?
Rodolite Aralda climbed up to the top of the hillside.
I wanted them formed up on the forward towers an hour ago to relieve the crossbowmen.
Before him, the battle clanged and screamed and grunted and thumped and roared. A band of Trollocs had surged across the river, crossing on ford rafts, and a crude floating bridge fashioned from log rafts. Trollocs hated crossing water. It took a lot to get them over, which was why this fortification was so useful. The hillside sloped directly down to the only ford of reasonable size in leagues. To the north, Trollocs boiled through a pass out of the Blight and ran right into the River Arunel. When they could be forced across, they faced the hillside, which had been dug with trenches, piled with bulwarks, and set with archer towers at the top. There was no way to reach the city of Maradon from the Blight except by passing over this hill. It was an ideal position for holding back a much larger force, but even the best fortifications could be overrun, particularly when your men were tired from weeks of fighting. The Trollocs had crossed and fought their way up the slope under a hail of arrows, falling into the trenches, having difficulty surmounting the high bulwarks. The hillside had a flat area at the top, where Iteralda had his command position in the upper camp. He called orders as he looked down on the woven mass of trenches, bulwarks, and towers. The Trollocs were dying to pikemen behind one of the bulwarks. Iteralda watched until the last Trolloc, an enormous ram-faced beast, roared and died with three pikes in its gut. It looked as if another surge was coming, the Murdrawl driving another mass of Trollocs through the pass. Enough bodies had fallen in the river that it was clogged for the moment, running red, the carcasses providing a footing for those running up behind.
Archers! Iteralda bellowed. Where are those bloody—
A company of archers finally ran past, some of the reserves he'd held back. Most of them had the coppery skin of Domani, though there were a few stray Terrabonners mixed in. They carried a wide variety of bows, narrow Domani longbows, serpentine Saldaean short bows scavenged from guard posts or villages, even a few tall Two Rivers longbows.
Lidren!
Iteralda called. The young hard-eyed officer hurried across the hillside to him. Lidren's brown uniform was wrinkled and dirty at the knees, not because he was undisciplined, but because there were times when his men needed him more than his laundry did.
"Go with those archers to the towers," Itaralda said. "Those Trollocs are going to try another push. I do not want another fist breaking through to the top, hear me? If they seize our position and use it against us, I'm going to have a rotten morning."
Lydran didn't smile at the comment, as he once might have. He didn't smile much at all anymore, usually only when he got to kill a Trolloc. He saluted, turning to jog after the archers. Itaralda turned and looked down the backside of the hill. The lower camp was set up there, in the shadow of the steep hillside. This hill had been a natural formation once, but the Saldaeans had built it up over the years, with one long slope extending toward the river and a steeper one on the opposite side. In the lower camp, his troops could sleep and eat, and their supplies could be protected, all sheltered from enemy arrows by the steep hillside upon which Itaralda now stood. Both of his camps, upper and lower, were patchwork things. Some of the tents had been purchased from Saldaean villages, some were of Damani make, and dozens had been brought in by Gateway from all over the land. A large number of them were enormous Kyrianan things with striped patterns. They kept the rain off his men, and that was enough. The Saldaeans certainly knew how to build fortifications. If only Itaralda had been able to persuade them to leave their hiding place in the city of Maradon and come help.
"Now," Itaralda said, "where in—"
He cut off as something darkened the sky. He barely had time to curse and duck away as a group of large objects rained down, arching high to fall on the upper camp, eliciting howls of pain and confusion. Those weren't boulders. They were corpses. The hulking bodies of dead Trollocs. The Shadowspawn army had finally set up their trebuchets. A part of Itaralda was impressed that he'd driven them to it. The siege equipment had undoubtedly been brought to assault Maradon, which was a little to the south. Setting up the trebuchets across the ford to assault Itaralda's lines instead not only would slow the Shadowspawn, but would expose their trebuchets to his counterfire. He hadn't expected them to hurl carcasses. He cursed as the sky darkened again, more bodies falling, knocking down tents, crushing soldiers.
"Healers!" Itaralda bellowed. "Where are those Ashaman?"
He'd pushed the Ashaman hard since this siege had begun, to the brink of exhaustion. Now he held them back, using them only when Trolloc assaults got too close to the upper camp.
"Sir!"
A young messenger with dirt under his fingernails scrambled up from the front lines. His Domani face was ashen, and he was still too young to grow a proper mustache.
"Captain Finsis reports the Shadowspawn army moving trebuchets into range. There are 16 by his count."
"Let Captain Finsis know that his bloody timing could be better," Itaralda growled.
"I'm sorry, my lord. They rolled them down through the pass before we figured out what was going on. The initial volley hit our watchpost. Lord Finsis himself was wounded."
Itaralda nodded. Rajabi was arriving to take command of the upper camp and organize the wounded. Below, a lot of bodies had hit the lower camp, too. The trebuchets could get the height and range to launch over the hill and fall down on his men in their previously sheltered area. He'd have to pull the lower camp back, farther across the plain toward Maradon, which would delay response times.
Bloody ashes. "I never used to swear this much," Itaralda thought. It was that boy, the dragon reborn. Randall Thor had given Itaralda promises, some spoken, some implied. Promises to protect Arad Doman from the Seanchan. Promises that Itaralda could live rather than die trapped by the Seanchan. Promises to give him something to do, something important, something vital, something impossible. Hold back the shadow. Fight until help arrived. The sky darkened and Itaralda ducked into the command pavilion, which had a wooden roof as a precaution against siege weapons. He'd feared spray shot of smaller rocks, not carcasses. The men scattered to help pull the wounded down to the relative safety of the lower camp, and from there across the plain toward Maradon. Rajabi led the effort. The lumbering man had a neck as thick as a 10-year-grown ash and arms nearly as wide. He now hobbled as he walked, his left leg hurt in the fighting and amputated beneath the knee.
Aes Sedai had healed him as best he could, and he walked on a peg. He'd refused to retire through gateways with the badly injured, and Aes Sedai hadn't forced him. You didn't throw away a good officer because of one wound. A young officer winced as a bloated carcass thumped against the top of the pavilion. The officer, Zhel, didn't have the coppery skin of a Domani, though he wore a very Domani mustache and a beauty mark on his cheek in the shape of an arrow. They could not hold against Trollocs here for much longer, not with the numbers they were fielding. Aes Sedai would have to fall back, point by point, farther into Saldaea, farther toward Arad Doman. Odd how he was always retreating toward his homeland, first from the south, now from the northeast. Arad Doman would be crushed between the Shan Chan and the Trollocs.
You'd better keep your word, boy.
He couldn't retreat into Maradon, unfortunately. The Saldaeans there had made it quite clear they considered Aes Sedai and the Dragon Reborn to be invaders. Bloody fools. At least he had a chance to destroy those siege engines. Another body hit the top of the command pavilion, but the roof held. From the stink, and in some cases splash, of those deceased Trollocs, they'd not chosen the newly dead for this assault. Confident that his officers were seeing to their duties, now was not the time to interfere. Aes Sedai clasped his hands behind him. Seeing him, soldiers both inside and out of the pavilion stood a little straighter. The best of plans lasted only until the first arrow hit, but a determined, unyielding commander could bring order to chaos by the way he held himself. Overhead, the storm boiled, clouds of silver and black, like a blackened pot, hanging above a cook fire, bits of steel shining through at the edges of the crusted soot. It was unnatural. Let his men see that he did not fear it, even when it hailed corpses upon them. Wounded were carried away, and men in the lower camp began to break it down, preparing to move it further back. He kept his archers and crossbowmen firing, pikemen ready along the bulwarks. He had a sizable cavalry, but couldn't use them here. Those trebuchets, if left alone, would wear his men down with boulders and spray shot, but Aes Sedai intended to see them burned first, using an Ashaman or a strike force with flaming arrows through a gateway. If only I could retreat into Maradon. But the Saldaean lord there wouldn't let him in. If Aes Sedai fell back to the city, he'd get smashed against those walls by the Trollocs.
Bloody, bloody fools.
What kind of idiots denied men refuge when an army of shadow spawn was knocking on their gates?
I want damage assessments, Aes Sedai said to Lieutenant Nils. Prepare the archers for an attack on those siege engines, cavalry, and bring two of the Ashaman who are on duty. Tell Captain Creedon to watch that Trolloc assault across the ford. They'll redouble their efforts following this barrage, as they'll presume us disordered.
The young man nodded and hastened off as Rajabi limped into the pavilion, rubbing his broad chin.
You guessed right again about those trebuchets. They did set them up to attack us.
I always try to guess right, Aes Sedai said. When I don't, we lose.
Rajabi grunted. Overhead, that storm boiled. In the distance, Aes Sedai could hear Trollocs calling, war drums beating, men shouting.
Something's wrong, Aes Sedai said. This whole bloody war is wrong, Rajabi said. We shouldn't be here. It should be the Saldaeans, their whole army. Not only the few horsemen the Lord Dragon gave us. More than that, Aes Sedai said, scanning the sky. Why carcasses, Rajabi? To demoralize us.
It was a not unheard of tactic. But the first volleys? Why not use stones when they'd do the most damage, and then move to bodies once surprise had been expended? The Trollocs hadn't a mind for tactics, but the Fades. They could be crafty. He'd learned that firsthand. As Aes Sedai stared at the sky, another massive volley fell, as if spawned by the dark clouds.
Light, where had they gotten that many trebuchets? Enough to throw hundreds of dead bodies.
There are 16 by his count, the boy had said. Not nearly enough. Were some of those carcasses falling too evenly?
It hit him like a burst of frozen rain. Those clever, bloody monsters.
Archers!
Iteralda screamed.
Archers, watch the skies! Those aren't bodies!
It was too late. As he yelled, the Drakkar unfurled their wings. Well over half of the carcasses in this volley were living shadow spawn, hiding among the falling bodies. After the first Drakkar attack on his army a few days back, he'd left archers on permanent rotation watching the skies day and night. But the archers didn't have orders to fire on falling bodies. Iteralda continued to bellow as he leaped out of the pavilion and whipped his sword from its scabbard. The upper camp became chaos as Drakkar dropped amid the soldiers. A large number of them fell around the command pavilion, their two large black eyes shining, drawing men toward them with their sweet songs. Iteralda screamed as loud as he could, filling his ears with the sound of his own voice. One of the beasts came for him, but his yell prevented him from hearing its croon. It looked surprised, as surprised as something so inhuman could look, as he stumbled toward it, pretending to be drawn, then struck an expert thrust through its neck. Dark blood dribbled down across milky white skin as Iteralda yanked his blade free, still screaming. He saw Rajabi stumble and fall to the ground as one of the shadow spawn leaped on him. Iteralda couldn't go to him. He was confronted by another of the monsters himself. In a blessed moment, he noticed balls of fire striking down Drakkar in the air, the Ashaman. But at the same time, in the distance, he heard the war drums grow louder. As he'd predicted, the churning force of Trollocs would be striking across the ford with as much strength as they ever had. Light, but sometimes he hated being right. You'd better keep your promise to send me help, boy, Iteralda thought as he fought the second Drakkar, his screaming growing hoarse. Light, but you'd better.
Fael strode through Perrin's camp, the air ringing with chattering voices, grunts of exertion, and calls of men giving orders. Perrin had sent one last request to the White Cloaks for parley, and there had been no reply yet. Fael felt refreshed. She'd spent the entire night nuzzled against Perrin atop their hill. She'd brought plenty of bedding and blankets. In some ways, the grassy hilltop had been more comfortable than their tent. The scouts had returned from Kyrian this morning. Their report would come soon. For now, Fael had bathed and eaten. It was time to do something about Berylane. She crossed the trampled grass toward the Myenar section of camp, feeling her anger rise. Berylane had gone too far. Perrin claimed that the rumors came from Berylane's maids, not the woman herself, but Fael saw the truth. The first was a master of manipulating and controlling rumor. That was one of the best ways to rule from a position of relative weakness. The first did so in Mayen, and she did the same here in camp, where Fael was the stronger party as Perrin's wife. A pair of winged guards stood at the entrance to the Mayenar section, their breastplates painted crimson, winged helmets shaped like pots and extending down the backs of their necks. They stood up taller as Fael neared, holding lances that were mostly ornamental, pennons flapping with the golden hawk in flight stenciled on their blue lengths. Fael had to crane to meet their eyes. "Escort me to your lady," she ordered. The guards nodded, one holding up a gauntleted hand and waving for two other men from inside the camp to take up the watch.
"We were told to expect you," the guard told Fael in a deep voice.
Fael raised an eyebrow. "Today?"
"No. The first simply said that should you come, you were to be obeyed."
"Of course I'm to be obeyed. This is my husband's camp." The guards did not argue with her, though they probably disagreed. Berylane had been sent to accompany Perrin, but he had not been given express command over her or her troops. Fael followed the men. The ground was, by a miracle, actually starting to dry out. Fael had told Perrin that she wasn't bothered by the rumors, but she was frustrated by Berylane's boldness. "That woman," Fael thought. "How dare she—" No, Fael couldn't continue down that path. A good shouting match would make her feel better, but it would reinforce the rumors. What else would people surmise if they saw her stalk to the first's tent, then scream at her? Fail had to be calm. That would be difficult. The Mayenner camp was arranged with lines of men radiating from a central tent like spokes on a wheel. The winged guard didn't have tents. Those were with Master Gil. But there was a very orderly arrangement to the groupings. They almost seemed too level. The folded blankets, the piles of lances, the horse poles and the periodic fire pits. Berylane's central pavilion was lavender and maroon. Salvage from Malden. Fael maintained her composure as the two towering guards led her up to the tent. One knocked on the post outside for permission to enter. Berylane's tranquil voice responded, and the guard pushed back the entrance flap for Fael. As she moved to enter, rustling inside made her step back, and Anura came out. The Aes Sedai nodded to Fael, the overlapping braids around her face swinging. She seemed displeased. She hadn't regained her mistress's favor yet. Fael took a deep breath, then stepped into the pavilion. It was cool inside. The floor was covered with a maroon and green rug of a twisting ivy pattern. Though the pavilion looked empty without Berylane's usual travel furniture, she did have a pair of sturdy oak chairs and a light table from Malden. The first rose. "Lady Fael," she said calmly. Today she wore the diadem of Mayenne. The thin crown had a simple grandeur about it, unornamented, save for the golden hawk, taking flight, as if leaping toward the sunlight streaming in patches through the tent ceiling. Flaps had been removed there to let in the light. The first's dress was gold and green, a very simple belt at her waist. The neckline plunging. Fael sat in one of the chairs. This conversation was dangerous. It could lead to disaster, but it had to be done.
"I trust you are well," Berylane said. "The rains of the last few days have not been overly taxing."
"The rains have been dreadful, Berylane," Fael said, "but I'm not here to talk about them." Berylane pursed perfect lips. Light, but the woman was beautiful. Fael felt downright dingy by comparison. Her nose too large, her bosom too small. Her voice wasn't nearly as melodic as Berylane's. Why had the Creator made people as perfect as Berylane? Was it mockery of the rest of them? But Beren didn't love Berylane. He loved Fael. Remember that.
"Very well," Berylane said. "I assumed this discussion would come. Let me promise you that the rumors are absolutely false. Nothing inappropriate happened between myself and your husband."
"He has told me that already," Fael said, "and I trust his word over yours." This made Berylane frown. She was a master of political interactions, possessing a skill and subtlety that Fael envied. Despite her youth, Berylane had kept her tiny city-state free from the much larger and powerful Tyr. Fael could only guess how much juggling, political double-dealing, and sheer cleverness that must have required.
"So why have you come to me?" Berylane asked, sitting down. "If your heart is at ease, then there is no problem."
"We both know that whether or not you slept with my husband is not an issue here," Fael said, and Berylane's eyes widened. "It isn't what happened, but what is presumed that angers me."
"Rumors can be found in any place where people are gathered," Berylane said, "particularly where men gossip."
"Such strong, persistent rumors are unlikely to have happened without encouragement," Fael said. "Now everyone in the camp, including the refugees sworn to me, assumes that you bedded my husband while I was away. This not only makes me look like a fool, but it casts a shadow upon Perrin's honor. He cannot lead if people take him for the type of man who will run to the arms of another woman the moment his wife is away. Other rulers have overcome such rumors, Berylaine said, and for many of them the rumors weren't unfounded. Monarchies survive infidelity. Perhaps in Ilion or Tyr, Fael said, but Saldea expects better of its monarchs, as do the people of the Two Rivers. Perrin is not like other rulers. The way his men look at him rips him apart inside. I think you underestimate him, Berylaine said. He will overcome, and he will learn to use rumor for his gain. That will make him stronger as a man and a ruler. Fael studied the woman. You don't understand him at all, do you? Berylaine reacted as if she'd been slapped, pulling back. She obviously didn't like the bluntness of this conversation. That might give Fael some slight advantage. I understand men, Lady Fael, Berylaine said coldly. And your husband is no exception. Since you have decided to be candid, I will return in kind. You were clever to take Abara when you did, welding Saldea to the dragon reborn. But do not think that he will remain yours without contest. Fael took a deep breath. It was time to make her play. Perrin's reputation has been severely damaged by what you have done, my lady first. For my own dishonor, I might have been able to forgive you. But not for his. I don't see what can be done. I do, Fael said. And I'm pretty certain one of us is going to have to die. Berylaine remained impassive. Excuse me? In the Borderlands, if a woman finds that another has been bedding her husband, she is given the option of open-knife combat. That was true, though the tradition was an old one, rarely observed any longer. The only way to clear my name is for you and me to fight. What would that prove? If nothing else, if you were dead, it would stop anyone from thinking that you are still sleeping with my husband behind my back. Are you actually threatening me in my own tent? This is not a threat, Fael said, remaining firm. Light, she hoped this went the right way. This is a challenge. Berylaine studied her, eyes calculating. I will make a public statement. I will publicly chastise my maids for their rumors and will tell the camp that nothing happened. Do you really think that would stop the rumors? You didn't object to them before my return. That is seen as proof. And of course, now you would be expected to act as if nothing happened. You can't be serious about this challenge. In regards to my husband's honor, Berylaine, I am always serious. She met the woman's eyes and saw concern there. Berylaine didn't want to fight her. And of course, Fael didn't want to fight Berylaine, and not just because she wasn't certain if she could win or not. Though she had always wanted to get revenge on the first, for that time when Berylaine had taken her knife from her. I will make the challenge formally this evening before the entire camp, Fael said, keeping her voice even. You will have one day to respond or leave. I will not be a party to this foolishness. You already are, Fael said, rising. This is what you set in motion the moment you let those rumors begin. Fael turned to walk from the tent. She had to work hard to hide her nervousness. Had Berylaine seen how her brow prickled with sweat? Fael felt as if she walked on the very edge of a sword. Should word of this challenge get to Perrin, he would be furious. She had to hope that... Lady Fael... Berylaine said from behind. The first's voice was edged with concern. Surely we can come to another accommodation. Do not force this. Fael stopped, heart thumping. She turned back. The first looked genuinely worried. Yes, she believed that Fael was bloodthirsty enough to make this challenge. I want you out of Perrin's life, Berylaine, Fael said. I will have that. one way or another.
You wish me to leave? Berylaine asked. The tasks the Lord Dragon gave me are finished. I suppose I could take my men and march another direction. No, Fael didn't want her to go. The disappearance of her troops would be a blow in the face of that looming White Cloak army, and Perrin would have need of the Winged Guard again, Fael suspected. No, Fael said. Leaving will do nothing for the rumors, Berylaine. It will do as much as killing me would, the woman said dryly. If we fight, and you somehow manage to kill me, all that would be said is that you discovered your husband's infidelity and became enraged. I fail to see how that would help your position. It would only encourage the rumors. You see my problem, then, Fael said, letting her exasperation show through. There seems to be no way to be rid of these rumors. Berylaine studied her. The woman had once promised she would take Perrin, had all but vowed it. She seemed to have backed off on that, in part, recently, and her eyes showed hints of worry. She realizes that she let this go too far, Fael thought, understanding. Of course. Berylaine hadn't expected Fael to return from Maldon. That was why she'd made such a bold move. Now she realized she'd overextended herself, and she legitimately thought Fael unhinged enough to duel her in public. I never wanted this, Berylaine, Fael said, walking back into the tent. And neither did Perrin. Your attentions are an annoyance to us both. Your husband did little to dissuade me, Berylaine said, arms folded. During your absence, there were points where he directly encouraged me. You understand him so little, Berylaine. It was amazing how the woman could be so blind while being so clever in other ways. So you claim, Berylaine said. You have two choices right now, Berylaine, Fael said, stepping up to her. You can fight me, and one of us will die. You're right, that wouldn't end the rumors, but it would end your chances at Perrin. Either you'd be dead or you'd be the woman who killed his wife. Your other choice, Fael said, meeting Berylaine's eyes, is to come up with a way that we can destroy these rumors once and for all. You caused this mess. You will fix it. And there was her gamble. Fael couldn't think of a way out of the situation, but Berylaine was much more accomplished in this regard than she was. So Fael came, prepared to manipulate Berylaine into thinking she was ready to do something unreasonable, then let the woman's impressive political acumen attack the situation. Would it work? Fael met Berylaine's eyes and allowed herself to feel her anger, her outrage at what had happened. She was being beaten, frozen, and humiliated by their common enemy. And during that, Berylaine has the gall to do something like this? She held the first's eyes. No, Fael did not have as much political experience as Berylaine, but she had something the woman didn't. She loved Perrin. Deeply. Truly. She would do anything to keep him from being hurt. The first studied her. Very well, she said. So be it. Be proud of yourself, Fael. It is rare that I take myself off a prize I have long desired. You haven't said how we could get rid of the rumors. There may be a method, Berylaine said, but it will be distasteful. Fael raised an eyebrow. We will need to be seen as friends, Berylaine explained. Fighting, being at odds, this will fuel the rumors. But if we are seen spending time with one another, it will disarm them. That, mixed with a formal renunciation on my part of the rumors, will likely be enough. Fael sat down in the chair she had been using earlier. Friends? She detested this woman. It would have to be a believable act, Verilaine said, rising and walking over to the serving stand at the corner of the tent. She poured herself some chilled wine. Only that would work. You'll find another man as well, Fael said. Someone you can give your attentions to, for a time at least, to prove that you are not interested in Perrin. Verilaine raised the cup. Yes, she said. I suspect that would help too. Can you put on such an act, Fael ni Bashir Tebara? You believed I was ready to kill you over this, didn't you? Fael thought. I promise it. Verilaine paused, wine cup halfway to her lips. Then she smiled and drank. We shall see then, she said, lowering the cup. What comes of this?